The theme for the afternoon talk is the process of identification. Quite often in our everyday world, we are very strongly encouraged to be and to become identified with, and that we may want to identify who we are. We want to be identified perhaps with our friends and our family. We want to be identified with the groups that we and circles that we move in, identified with our culture, with our religion, with our nation, etc. So there's a lot of encouragement for us to be identified with. And also, of course, we can become very much identified with our interpretation of who we are. We become identified with various activities through our life. We identify with what we have succeeded in. We identify with what we have failed in. We have identified with what we have accomplished and owned and got, etc. So at every level of life, there is this strong encouragement about the value of becoming identified with. In Dharma language, there's not a good word to be said about being identified with anything. So this is a kind of challenge to us, to our usual construction of our view of the world, both with our feelings, our thoughts, our perceptions, in order that we explore and try to find out what it is to really open up our life, to really shake up our life, to wake up our life, and to see whether all of this identification with is in fact a form of imprisonment. Is it a form of isolation? Is it a form of living an existence like a chicken, as the Buddha said, in a shell? And sometimes we hardly realize how much of a shell we are living in through what we are identified with. And so then what we have identified with, we're locked into. And when we're locked into that, we have to keep out. We have to push away from. It isn't an easy thing, therefore, to identify with something. It isn't easy to question what we're identified with, etc. Just recently, I just remember, because I got this watch in front of me, that about 15 years ago, a good friend of mine, one of the Dharma teachers, Sharda, gave me this watch. And as those of you know who have these batteries in these watches, they last whatever, 2 or 3 years. So then the watch suddenly stopped, and I remember, well, I've only had the battery in there for less than a year. So maybe after 15 years of using this watch, maybe it's finished and it's worn out or whatever. So I went into the watch shop in Totnes, the town where I live, and I said, I think probably the watch is just worn out, but it just could be the battery. So he said to me, well, do you have any nostalgic value for this watch? He said, if it is broken, we could repair it, but to repair the watch will cost you more than the price of the new one. Funny world we live in. So he said, if you're really identified with it, you might really want to keep it, but it will cost you if it has to be repaired. And anyway, he looked at it, he says, no problem, the battery's worn out. So sometimes we identify with something very strongly, or with someone, whatever it might be, and that identification with often means we want continuity of. So if you think about anything which you are identified with, whoever, whatever, could be anything from a marriage to a job to the feeling of who you are, or whatever it may be, whatever we are identified with, we often want some, or expect some kind of continuity. So in the exploration with you today, I would like to look at this I identification with, however that might be. And in the looking at that, to see and examine whether in our life there is this feeling of I which arises within us, experiences of it which we give enormous importance to, and some sense of this I and what I identify with. Just in the course of today, if you just give some reflection in the course of today, what's been your strongest experience of today? What has been most outstanding for you today? What's been in the inner life, what, as it were, been coming up mostly? And sometimes there's a certain intensity that can go with it. You remember one of your relatives, they're always popular for identification with, and so the memory of a relative arises: father, son, mother, daughter, uncle, aunt, brother, sister, child, grandchildren, the full catastrophe. And one remembers. So the role, as we're touching a little bit, of oneself, one is identified with the role in that family or circle of relatives, and one remembers then another relative. So the sense of two relatives, me, whatever it might be, son, father, brother, whatever, and the other, arises. And the identification with the role, I am a brother, son, father, mother, sister, cousin, aunt, whatever. The identification with the role produces and contributes the identification of somebody else in their role, and one can spend the whole day in an internal conflict. Why are they like this? I should do this. They said this to me. When I see them next time, I'm going to say, I can't wait for this retreat to be over, so I can really go and say what I really have wanted to say to them for the last 50 years. They will get it at the end of this retreat Thursday night. This is called being identified with. So sometimes the state of mind and the tendency which is taking place inside of us, the feeling of I arises, there is a tendency of mind. In this case, it's called revenge. It's called blame. It's called finding fault. It's called I don't like them, or whatever. So the self arises, the sense of I in me arises, and it arises with the tendency. The self goes with the tendency, negativity, blame, fault finding, and many others, of course. And that identification with the tendency helps one to believe in it, to accept it, to confirm it, and sometimes painfully to act on it. Why? Because we've identified with it. The self has become the tendency. The self has become the reaction. And when the self becomes the reaction, anything can happen upon anybody. Sometimes it's the same, so to speak, towards ourselves. We have a tendency to look at ourselves in a particular way. Let's say one of the most popular ones, it's like an epidemic, it's called self-blame. It's called lack of self-acceptance. It's called self-rejection. So there's the movement of the tendency, and the self identifies with it. It's towards this little bundle of human activity. There is a reaction against it. We put ourselves down. We find fault with ourselves. We say we are not good enough, etc. It doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from a history. It's an accumulated tendency which goes on, and the identification with it gives it its reality. It only gets the reality through the strength of how much one identifies with it. Supposing we lost interest in identifying with it. Supposing we said, oh, look, there's an old tendency coming up towards my mother, always a popular target for many, or anybody else, or towards oneself. Oh, look, this tendency is just manifesting in the moment. That seeing it just as a tendency, rather than being identified with it, may be a helpful contribution to taking some of the power out of it. Just a tendency. It's just an inner movement manifesting in the moment. And so there's a lot of encouragement in the teachings and in our practices to free ourselves up, or to free our inner life up towards the tendency of identification with, towards dissolving or dropping, or not being so caught up in the sense of I, me and mine. And any freeing of the being needs and requires from us some looking at the I, the me and the mine. Sometimes we look, we could take a talk as an example. We ask ourselves, where, this is an important question in life, where is the pleasant? Where is the pleasant? Because on something pleasant, we can go from pleasant to liking, to attraction, to desiring, to desperately needing, to I must have, etc., to shop till you drop, etc. It all starts off with the pleasant. Think about it. Think about anything in life which you have gone for. Anything, any of us gone for. Anything we say, oh, I would like to have, I need, I must have, I can't live without, etc., which is always a lie. So it needs, the initial contact is a pleasant feeling. Anything that we're attracted towards is something pleasant. And on this peculiar experience of what is pleasant, everything starts to build. in the present world. So, yet we forget, where is this pleasant? You could say, maybe, possibly. Right now I'm sitting on the floor, and I'm listening to some Dharma teachings, and whatever it is, a quarter of an hour has gone by, and so far, apart from the pain in my knees, my back and everything else, one might say, when I'm listening, it's quite pleasant to listen to worse things in life, your Prime Minister, and apologies for those of you anyway, and I have to endure mine, you think about it, and so we say, okay, there's something pleasant there, and we say, oh, it's interesting what he says, it's quite interesting, it's quite a pleasant thing to listen to, it's quite helpful. So is the pleasant coming from what's over here? I said, yeah, you might think, oh, it's coming from what's over here. Yeah, because it's not somebody else, etc. Or is it just inside of myself? Where is the pleasant? Where is it? Etc. So if we imagine, oh, the pleasant is just because of the speaker who is speaking, and he's not shouting at us, and he's not yelling, and he's not having a screaming tantrum yet, etc. So it's quite pleasant to listen to. And one might, if one has little interest, the pleasantness might stay for half an hour or 40 minutes. For some, it might even go for an hour. Supposing I said, I carried on into the second hour. The level of the pleasantness may start to go down quickly, and then it's no longer pleasant. It hasn't got to the unpleasant stage, it hasn't got for the painful, I can't stand listening to this 1 minute logger. And so the same activity, you're sitting there, Christopher is talking, it starts off pleasant, time goes by, more time it gets pleasant to not pleasant to unpleasant. How much longer? Then it gets into the second hour or the third hour. I'll scream if I have to hear one more word from this person, etc. So the same thing is going on outwardly, still talking on and off. And the feeling life inwardly has changed, etc. But then it may not stay at the miserable, painful, and then something could be said in the third or fourth hour which is actually useful. I think, oh, that's interesting. I'm glad I'm here. I really, it was worth putting up with all that misery of him. And then it's gone from the painful, oh, this is pleasant, this is interesting. And it starts another cycle. Still talking, etc. In the East, in the West, we're more respectful of the amount of time of talking. General sense is 45 minutes, maybe an hour. But Asian teachers have no concept. They have their own sense of what timelessness means. The record I have heard, I have to say. The teacher started off Tibetan, as always. 5:30 in the evening he started off. A friend of mine was there. And I've listened to this Tibetan teacher. He is not a thrill a minute, I have to tell you. 5:30 started off. At 1:30 in the morning he says, I think I've spoken enough. Etc. Even with huge amount of devotion which he inspires from his disciples and students, I can't believe that anyone could listen to anybody from 5:30 in the evening to 1:30 in the morning and say this was one continual pleasant experience. It is beyond the odds. So, is the pleasantness out there? Is it? Even that which is pleasant about anything, even we say, like some of you I noticed have picked up this peculiar American habit of every time I look, I can hardly believe my eyes. Peanut butter jam sandwiches. I can remember the first time I saw this was in 1979. It's one of those unforgettable observations of life. A friend of mine, Dan American, slapped the peanut butter on, half a jar. I thought, God! And then he's looking around for the blackberry jam. Extraordinary. This is called pleasant. For some of us, the perception was, oh God, save me. Etc. I've never tasted this combination in my entire life, and I hope I go to the grave and I never taste it. Maybe I'm missing out on something. Anyway. So, we say, oh, the jam and the peanut butter is pleasant. But is it? For some of us, not. So something goes on from the pleasant. Some identification with it. Some movement towards. And part of awareness and practice is looking and connecting and taking an interest in the pleasant feeling, the pleasant sensation, which is all too human, obviously. And the important question is, what do we make of it? What do we make of it? And how much do we make of it? Because that which is pleasant can undergo change and transformation and become painful. Marriage is the greatest contemporary example. Starts off in heaven and concludes in hell. As most of us know through bitter experience. All right. So it's good to take some awareness in life to... But that's not always always the case. For those of you who have very happy marriages, etc. So sometimes our awareness matters. Our awareness matters, and one of the important aspects for liberating the heart, for freeing up the inner life, is a very important question. Am I holding and am I clinging to the way things were? Not only the way things are, but the way things were. Are there areas of my life about anything which tell me I have identified with the way things were? And when you and I hold on to the past, identify with the way things were, we become increasingly upset or increasingly angry or increasingly feel hurt, because the mind refuses to make the shift to the present through the intensity and the degree of holding to the way things were. And life refuses, it will not fit in this way. Life refuses to be agreeable. It just does not cooperate. And so the inner change that goes on, we change, you and I change, or the outer changes that go on, remind us, the changes remind us, there is no point in identifying with the way things were. Only for one reason, they change. That anything. And if you and I hold to the pleasant memory and how it used to be, it's a lot harder to deal with today. because we're living in the comparison of what it was yesterday, and all of that energy that you and I put into how nice it was, how lovely it was, and I remember when, and all of that boring nostalgia for the past, it takes away our inner resources, it weakens our strength, our inner power to actually attend to how things are, because we're refusing to accept how things are, because we want how things were. And as we all know, even if there's little clinging to the past and little holding on to the past, it's still a huge challenge for us to deal with the present. But it's a lot easier if you and I have freed our being up and freed up our inner life in such a way that we're clearly and hopefully cleanly not holding on to yesteryear, because we've got enough to deal with today already. Yeah. Now looking in our looking into this whole phenomena of identification with the kind, it's not the kind of change over, and this often brings rather a lot of confusion or difficulty. And people will say to me, and or to others will say, oh, if I'm not identified with, then it will feel, I would feel rather alienated, I will feel rather cut off, rather distant, rather remote. Actually, it's not true at all. It is actually, it's fundamentally quite different. If one is not identified with, our inner life, our consciousness, has a much greater sense of being open and receptive. It's those who are identified with who experience the most cutting off. Because if you and I are very strongly identified with something, then I will feel more distant from others, etc. I mean, look at this recent situation with the nightmare of the war upon the Iraqi people, and then the majority of the French people and British people as well, quite against this whole conflict and this whole war that took place. And so then this childish reaction in the United States that took place, when, because the French people didn't support the war, then they changed it from French fries to freedom fries, I thought. the level of intelligence is extraordinary. And so there is an identification with a view. And the only way of resolving it is calling them freedom fries. So when there's identification with the view and the holding to the position, what it easily creates is a rejection of, a distance from. And therefore, identification with increases the isolation, it increases the separation. Through the holding to, it's keeping out. But supposing we're breaking the shell, supposing we're saying we're all human beings, all the labels are meaningless because they're sources for identification. So as we crack the shell of that, we're just on this earth together, human beings, and all the rest is a form of identification which alienates, then something's going to happen to the perceptions. something's going to happen to the heart, something's going to happen to the way we treat people, because we're not identifying exclusively with one small group or one nation or one religion or one philosophy or whatever it might be. And I've said here in my regular visits to Israel, you've got three religions often at war with each other. The last thing you want is Buddhism in this country. You know, you only have four religions all going at each other. So we don't need Buddha images and all this entertainment. Here's enough of that around already. But maybe a little bit in the Dharma teachings help us to look at, is our way of being in a shell? If it is in a shell, then that shell will contribute to alienation. If we break the shell, if we're willing to look at what we identify with, perhaps our inner life can open up in extraordinary ways. And that would bring out of us love and connection and respect and concern and compassion in a way which an imprisoned life to the shell can't do it. It brings war. It brings conflict. Just in Saranath, when the Buddha was giving his teachings, Brian and I and others, Stephen was with us as well, we had, you know, a number of people come over the days for our Dharma gathering that we have here. This is a place just outside Varanasi where the Buddha gave these teachings on the middle way. And after one of the sitting, an American woman from California, probably around 60 years of age, she said to me, this was in the middle of February, I've just had a realization, just had an insight in my sitting. And she said, I've decided to go to Baghdad and be a human shield. And I said to her, are you sure? Are you really sure you want to do this? And I advised and suggested to her, because sometimes people have great ideas in their meditation, and then after a cup of chai there's a rapid change of mind. So I said, please don't be in a rush. I respect your I think most of you know what a human shield is. It is to go to a war zone and to be present and give support to the ordinary civilians and express an intimacy, a contact, a support for them. And the next day she spoke and she says, I've slept on it, thought about it, and she said, I am definitely going to do this. I have decided. And I think it expresses in a way great courage, some will say a lot of naivety, some may view, but it also shows, of course, not being identified with the ideology and the belief systems of the White House, etc. And she's listening to herself in that rather free and independent spirit, which many of us love and respect greatly. So she left and flew to London, boarded one of the buses. There was 200 or 300 people making the journey on the buses through to Jordan, through to Iman, crossing over and Syria, and then crossing through and to Iraq. And I didn't hear anything. Didn't hear anything at all. And then I picked up a newspaper, the Independent newspaper, and my favorite Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk, who I sometimes corresponded a bit with, there was a report, and lo and behold, she's there. And she's staying with a family, and the family's next to an oil storage place just on the edge of Baghdad, and she's staying with the caretaker and his family and another young English guy who was about 25 or 26. So while all the hell was breaking loose in and around the city, she just, to the end, she just stayed with the family. And that family said, as the caretaker said, who had 6 or 7 children and had his relatives, he said there's 16, 17 relatives around in houses nearby, just her presence gave all of them much more strength. But it also changed their picture of what an American citizen is. It gave a different sense of what it is to be an American. And that's powerful. And that was because she was willing to break out of the so-called stereotyped American identity, which many people in this part of the world understandably can get, as well as in America. So I say, sometimes when we're willing to question, when we're willing to look at the shells that we are living in and help to break out of them, something in the consciousness can start to shift, can start to move, as it did for her in this case, one sitting. I don't know exactly what happened, I don't know how it happened or whatever. She says, I've never done anything like this before in my entire life. I don't know where it came from inside of me, but she did it. So these kind of explorations, and sometimes just the seeds which are taking place within us, may help to, as I pointed out, to kind of open up our life a little bit more, to have a bigger sense about it, a bigger vision about it. Sometimes in that movement of the tendency, and this is never an easy one to deal with, and most of us have had to go through this, there are periods in life of what we call, what we might call transition. There are periods in our life where the tendency of our life may be going along in a fairly systematic way. There is a certain kind of reliability about it. We're studying. We're in a relationship. We're not in relationship. We're working. And there's a certain kind of familiarity or routine, which can be fine, obviously, and can carry us all through life. But the circumstances of life never pay any respect to routine. There's no chance. Not a chance for that. So sometimes from the outer, the routine is disturbed. It's called losing a job or whatever. Sometimes the routine of our life is dramatically changed from within. We simply cannot carry on with what we were doing. Sometimes we can't explain it to ourselves. So how can we explain it to our loved ones? Sometimes our mind cannot explain why there is a loss of identification with what we have been doing. We just can't. We think about it and think, I must be crazy. Why am I stopping this? Why am I not continuing this? Why do I have to change? And as I said, it may come from out. So sometimes the identification with what we have been doing breaks, stops. Then we're in transition. And in the transition, we don't know what we're making a transition to. This period of no longer being identified with what we were or what we were doing, not having a hope in hell of what we might do, and we're right in the middle of it. And as people often say when who are in this, and somebody comes up, an old friend or a stranger or family member, "Oh, what are you doing nowadays?" Nothing, actually. And we can feel very bad about that. We want to feel productive. We want to be back as a machine or whatever. And it doesn't sound very good saying nothing. And we lack confidence to be able to say, when somebody asks, "What are you doing?" "Nothing." It takes a certain confidence to say, I've done nothing all day, and get to the end of the day and say, "I've done nothing all day, and that was too much." It takes a certain confidence inside of oneself. There. So the pressures that come from outside and the expectations upon us make it difficult to be in the transition, or the old identity of the expectations upon ourselves there. But many of the deep things of life have flowered through, have come through for people who have been willing to say no to what was, not know what will be, and be in the unknown of what is. Many people who have undergone deep transformation have been willing to live through that process, have been willing to endure that, to go through that. Never easy, but it's a process of non-identification with, in order to live with the unknown, with all the insecurity. And despite many people taking this, "Oh, you can't live like that." you can't just you've got to think about your pension plan, you know. Pension, your life insurance. What life insurance? Those of us who are in the grey-haired club, you never know. One day to the next, might have a few minutes left on this earth, or you might have 10 or 20 years. What hope for life insurance? So if we're willing to feel the insecurity, to feel not being identified with something strong and powerful about it, even though there are many messages of resistance. And that doesn't mean to say that we have to flee our loved ones or run away from our family or whatever. That process of change and process of transition and insecurity can take place even if we have a job, or if we are studying, or if we have responsibilities for others. But the inquiry inside, the investigation inquiry inside, the looking into, can continue. And as I said with one of the people on the retreat here, who said, "Well, it's too hard to live like this." So I was quoting Rilke, the poet Rilke I mentioned, I think, yesterday. But sometimes, while the everyday life is going on, the so-called responsibilities, the so-called commitments that you and I have in all sorts of ways to the immediate world which are around us, is it possible for us to keep the questioning alive? And as Rilke reminds us in his letters to the young poet, live your question. Live your questioning, so that we have a feeling, I may not know what liberation is, I may not know what awakening is, I may not know what freedom of spirit really means, but I'm questioning where I'm stuck, I'm questioning what I'm identified with. I'm questioning what I've cut myself off from through living in a shell. And the very questioning, as the Buddha says, will start to crack the shell. And things will start to open up for us, because we've been willing to live with the everyday truth of things. Life is insecure. That's how it is. It is insecure. And sometimes when we can feel it, in all the way that you and I can feel it about anything in life, maybe we're a bit closer to it, and we kind of stop resisting it. And maybe there's something quite vitalizing about it, and then it's worth taking a few steps for, and it's worth taking a few risks for, and it's worth stepping out of our usual conceptions and our usual tendencies, because life is insecure. So let's feel the touch of it, let's feel the edge of it, and all of that helps to wake up the whole being. Let's have a couple of quiet minutes.